I like to say, like, if you're doing this correctly, you're not selling, you're inviting. And at the same time, if you have an emotionally engaged audience, you can increase your profit margin up to 30% before that emotionally engaged audience will go, now I'm not sure. Because at that point, they trust you. And you know what's even better? They go tell their friends about you. They go post about you. People become embodied extensions of your brand when they feel like they belong with your brand as their authentic selves. Would you rather have like 300 leads in the next 30 days that don't convert? Or would you rather build a relationship with 30 people who buy from you for the rest of their life and tell everyone about what you do?
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Chelsea Burns, otherwise known as the marketing psychologist, about the connection between how our brains are wired and the brands we choose. Chelsea is uniquely qualified to talk about this. She has a master's in psych, has spent 17 years in marketing, and has been in therapy most of her life. So, spoiler alert, most of the purchasing decisions we make, we make them subconsciously. Savvy marketers know this, so we're all vulnerable to being manipulated into buying things we don't need. I have a drawer full of late night Instagram purchases I'm too embarrassed to return. And Chelsea shares real life examples of some of these bad actors and arms us with the brain science we need to protect ourselves. But here's the exciting part. We can use this knowledge for good. As employees, we can build personal brands that create authentic connections with the people we work with. As entrepreneurs, we can build ethical companies that give our customers a sense of belonging so they never want to leave. This isn't just a conversation for marketers. It's for anyone who wants to be more conscious about the choices they make and the messages they put out into the world. Please enjoy Chelsea Burns. Welcome, Chelsea, to the podcast. This is going to be awesome.
I am so excited to be here. I woke up this morning and checked my calendar and I was like, it's going to be a good day.
It is going to be a good day. So you're the first, not only my first guest from Wichita, but probably the first person that I've ever met from Wichita. So the only thing I know about it is that it's mentioned in the White Stripes. They're probably their most famous song, Seven Nation Army. Mm-hmm. So when you tell people you live in Wichita, what's the first thing they ask?
Oh, like Kansas City?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, actually most of Kansas City is in Missouri. Oddly though, more and more people are like, oh, I've heard of Wichita or I've been there. And I was listening in on this really cool speech from someone who's doing downtown development. And I didn't realize, I mean, I'm from the area my entire life. Wichita is actually like the 50th largest city in the United States.
Well, I don't think you can blame people for being a little confused that most of Kansas City is in Missouri.
Yeah.
First of all.
Yes. There's a fun fact for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're a marketing expert. So if someone was thinking of moving to Kansas or taking a vacation there or to Wichita, what would the main selling feature be?
Oh my goodness. The main selling feature for me is that Wichita is like small town, big city.
Mm.
So you get this beautiful mix of urban life. There's museums, there's art, there's music. There's really like some very interesting culture and history, but then you also can be out in wide open spaces in like less than 10 minutes. So it's just a really beautiful place to be. And the pace is a little bit slower. And honestly, you can't beat the cost of living. So it might be the cheapest vacation you take.
Okay. All right. Well, there's so much of your story and the stuff that you talk about on LinkedIn that I'm excited to dig into. You've got a really strong presence on LinkedIn as what you've branded yourself as a marketing or the marketing psychologist, which I want to talk a lot about. So what came first, psychology or marketing for you?
So marketing came first. I've been an in-house marketer for 17 years. I got my master's in applied psychology from USC. But interestingly enough, my education was not the start of my psychology interest. I started a personal therapy journey almost 11 years ago now. And that is actually what started this whole thing, where I was learning about my own brain and stepping into my marketing roles going, wait a second. Like, you learn a little bit about like business psychology and some of that as you go through school or like if you take trainings. But it wasn't really the same. It's all very isolated to individual moments and touch points. And the things that I was learning about the human brain were just wildly complex. And so that's actually where that started.
When you think about that, is there something you remember learning in your therapy journey that sort of started that connection to the marketing side?
Yeah. So I have a bit of a trauma background. And without getting into too many details, one of the very first things that I had to start to learn was how my brain was wired to be in relationship with other people and how my brain was kind of programmed and mapped by those experiences in a way in which they predisposed me or, you know, put me in positions to see certain things, maybe even unhealthy situations, as normal or okay, or even sometimes good. Mm. And so the relationship part of it is what really struck me, because I was like, yes, I'm in, you know, there's a lot of different components, branding, marketing, communications, all different things. I worked in higher ed at the time. So a lot of stuff, like you become like, you wear all the hats. And it was just so clear to me that it was like, well, we're just building relationships with people. We're trying to get them. Yes, we want their attention, but we want their trust. You work for a university, like you have to win the hearts of a 17-year-old, which is not easy to do. And then you also have to be their parents' favorite choice, right? So you're navigating some pretty complex relationships. And that was the big thing for me, was like, this is not some sort of simplified thing. There are ways for us to be very cognizant of the fact that we are in relationship with these people. And here's all these things I'm learning about the brain and situations to identify healthy relationships. Why not just pull them on over?
Yeah, man, that's fascinating. And there's just so many ties, I guess, between that and some of the work you do around manipulative marketing. And yeah, if you start with the basis that we're in the business of building relationships, then I can see how a lot of that background with, you know, therapy and understanding the nature of how the brain works kind of ties naturally to all those things. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, one of the things that I've explored really deeply now that I'm full-time entrepreneur and on my own is that like, it is directly tied to my ethos. Right? Like, this is not just a persona that you're getting online, and I'm teaching brands how to do it. Like, I have pretty like hard and fast boundaries in my personal life too around these things. I teach my children these things. So it feels very in flow and in alignment, because it is coming from a place of passion as well.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Chelsea. That's very much the impression that I get from your persona on LinkedIn. And it was reinforced when I got to chat with you in person for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And so when I meet people like that on LinkedIn that seem to have found a truly authentic passion of theirs and built a business around it, I'm like, damn, like that's the promised land. Like, how do people do that? So, but my experience tells me that when I find people like that, their story is much more complex and it's not as glossy and perfect as it seems. So what's been the hardest part of that journey for you?
So my transition into entrepreneurship was not some sort of like a planned move over. Looking back on it, like I have to give my gut some credit. I think I knew that I was not in alignment with a lot of things. You know, I reached marketing VP, over six-figure salary shortly after I turned 30. That was supposed to be the dream. And then you get up there and go, wow, it's just like really, this was the wrong ladder. Like, oh shit, now what do I do? So tried to pivot, but still within the corporate space. and was really trying to override my gut intuition and be like, no, this is totally fine. I can go to this very vanilla job and work with pretty close-minded people. And like, I can do this. It's going to be okay. And it wasn't okay. And yeah, so that exit out of that was not on like the best of terms. I didn't feel super in control of the situation. And what's interesting is that this kind of story of origin is, I'm writing a book and it is the prologue of my book. So I feel very prepared to answer your question because I spent a lot of time sitting here going like, okay, what actually happened? Because I talk to dozens of people every week who are like, man, you got it together. And I'm over here going, I fell ass backward into this, people. Like, now that's not entirely fair. I know my therapist, if she's going to listen to this, is going to be like, hey, no, give yourself some credit. But it really was a process of self-reflection. Everything comes back to the ability to really know yourself too, right? You can't be in relationship with others unless you're in relationship with yourself. And so it was kind of this interesting, time warped parallel where this couch behind me, I like totally, brain's just buzzing. I go sit crisscross applesauce on this couch and go, wow, I'm starting from the beginning. What do I even do? What do I want to do? So our brains have kind of, they have like some sensory memory, right? So like I'm sitting crisscross applesauce on this couch and I immediately go back 10, 11 years to my first therapy session where I walk in and I'd never been in a therapist office, but I watch enough movies. I was like, oh, I'm going to sit on a comfy couch or a chaise lounge, right? And this very smart, well-dressed person is going to sit across from me and like poignantly take notes about all of these profound things that come out of my mouth. And then I'm going to leave and my life is going to be changed. And that was not the case. I learned that I had experienced enough trauma at an early age to not have memories. And so when you don't have memories, you can't talk about them. So it was decided that I would actually sit crisscross applesauce on the floor and do different forms of like play therapy and other modalities that are reserved for children who can't actually articulate a lot of the things they need to in like your typical talk therapy. And my takeaway there was like, I wasn't ready for the couch. I eventually worked my way to the couch, right? And so I'm sitting on the couch behind me and I'm like, man, all those people, like all those friction points, like they weren't ready for the couch. So like, maybe that's what I do. Maybe I go help people and guide people and teach people and share all of this knowledge and perspective so they can sit on the couch. And that's how I got to the point of being like, okay, well, I'm going to put marketing and I'm going to put psychologist in my headline. And I did, and it blew up.
Well, there's something so incredibly authentic and real about that. That's not something that somebody could just make up.
Right.
Like it's a very personal, real story. Because the thing that immediately comes to mind for me is, have you found a way to almost find some gratitude for that trauma, given that it led to the therapy and this life that has worked out pretty well so far?
You know, you want to talk about some synergy. It was probably only a couple of weeks ago that I do a lot of walking. I do a lot, miles and miles a day of walking, processing, thinking, sitting, letting that creativity kind of happen. And I had this moment of like, man, I have really released a lot of the guilt and the shame and the why me and the, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda. And I'm like, I wouldn't be who I am if I wouldn't have gone through all of those things. And I had the agency to make the choices I made to go down the paths that I did. So like, yes, external factors, all these things happen, but it's actually quite empowering to look back and go like, no, I got knocked down plenty of times, but like I got back up. And would I have the courage, the bravery, the gumption, the ambition, the drive, all the things to go through a process like entrepreneurship, which is very difficult and one of the most difficult things out of everything I've experienced. And so I think I have gotten to that point where there is a part of me that's grateful for the experiences that have happened and shaped me.
Yeah, because I imagine if your therapist is listening to this and hear you say you fell ass backwards into it, you know that's not true, right? Like there are other people that would have gone through those experiences that wouldn't have had the tools or perspectives that you've had.
Yeah.
And, you know, the outcome would have been very different. So, God, that's so amazing. And yeah, coming back to one other thing you said, you know, you were on the wrong ladder. I think, man, I can, when you were describing that experience, I was on that ladder. I made VP. I was making good money, more than I ever had.
Yeah.
And it was gross. Like it wasn't healthy. It was kind of toxic. And I don't love what it brought out in me. I did my best. And I don't know. I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah. I mean, we're all given this narrative that that is success. And for certain parts of my life, that was very fulfilling. And there are different phases in life. Like nothing is permanent, you know? And so there's different times and places and phases and companies and roles where like those things work. But I do also think there's an opportunity to stay open to what you're being called to do as well. And I am a firm believer in duality. So, you know, there's no day without night. In the same way, it's like there's always the flip side of it. If something bad is happening, there's a good to the other side. And so I think, too, a lot of that narrative strips us of our agency. You know, I mean, I have a whole nother monologue about how corporate speak strips us of our humanity. So we could maybe circle back to that. But it certainly does strip us of our agency. We have no choice. And we do have choice. And we have way more choice than we think we do.
Mm.
But my perspective is like the human brain is hardwired to keep us safe and secure and surviving, even though many of those constructs are not real, like they're not achievable, right? But like, it's a really terrifying thing to realize just how much agency you do have.
Right. Because then you feel a responsibility to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
It does strike me too, and I imagine maybe you've thought of this too, is that I think I had to go through that. Like if I never made VP, I think it always would have bothered me somewhere, even if I didn't admit it. So I think I had to go through that, realize, okay, it's not all it's cracked up to be. It's not really for me. And then, you know, use that as an experience to shape whatever the next thing looks like. So some of it, I guess, is that, you know, my dad was never an executive. My parents wanted me to go to school. They wanted me to get a job. They wanted me to be successful. And so that was sort of the path that I felt, you know, obliged to take. And I guess the greatest responsibility I feel now as a parent is that just to make sure my kids know that that doesn't have to be like that. And if they choose that, that's great. But, and it's not like my parents ever explicitly said it. And maybe it's just my own, you know, baggage that I sort of brought to that. But I just hope, and I do think that our kids today in general have more options and see their mom like you doing brave things out there, creating her own journey. I didn't have an example like that. So I just did what I thought, you know, what came naturally.
Yeah. What's interesting is that I did have an example of that. My dad is a self-employed commercial electrician and a farmer. And so he was always entrepreneuring it. But I was a first generation college student, a college graduate, and, you know, went on to get a master's degree. And there was just something about going that opposite direction, because the thing is I also watched him work really, really hard. So I don't know if maybe I subconsciously was like well aware of the type of rigor and work it takes to like put your own, you know, business together.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. So let's talk about the marketing side and the stuff that you talk about a lot on LinkedIn. You've talked about how everything we buy is based on emotion, even sometimes subconscious. At least that's what I think I read. So you can correct me. And that it's only kind of afterwards that we use logic to justify, you know, what our emotions are telling us. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Do I have that right?
Yeah. So 95% of our decision making occurs in the subconscious brain. So when you flip that around, only 5% of what you're deciding on is like an active conscious thought. So it's quite fascinating, right? And what happens is what we've discovered is that it is a subconscious emotional trigger that gets us to that point of buying. Now, depending on what it is, right, it's a lot different if you're like, oh, I'm in the checkout at the grocery store and I'm going to grab this candy bar versus, you know, maybe a purchase for a car or a house or a luxury product of some kind. Like, that's where there's that pause and there's that lingering. And we do use logic to try to reason ourselves through all the things. Mm-hmm. But it's that hidden emotional trigger that starts the whole thing. And what's interesting is that when you start talking about branding, marketing, advertising, they're neurologically creating pathways in your brain. That's what advertising is. Neuropathways are like, think about going on a walk somewhere, right? You walk through a field and you walk that same path all the time. Eventually that grass starts to die off. It's just dirt, right? That's kind of like a neural pathway. The more frequently it is traveled, the more rooted it is. So then you go to the store and you're not even aware of the fact that your brain is automatically going to Heinz ketchup faster than it's going to any other brand. It's recognizing it way faster than you're consciously even thinking about it, because your brain has consumed more Heinz ketchup ads and a neural pathway is there. And it is not connected to you. They don't show you the tomatoes they put, you know what I mean? Like, it's all about, how does this tie into your family? How does this tie into your life? Look at this great barbecue you're having, da, 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 da. You're grabbing for that ketchup because they've associated them with themselves, with that feeling, right? And they've trained your brain to go there the fastest.
So I think we all sort of kind of understand that's happening. And one of the things you talk about a lot is kind of manipulative marketing, which I want to dig into. Like, don't we all kind of accept that, yes, I understand that marketing is trying to get me to buy something that maybe I don't need. And so we're sort of signing up for some of that manipulation. Like, how do you draw the line between, I don't know, persuasion and manipulation?
Brilliant question. And a conversation that starts happening on a lot of my posts, which I absolutely love. Let's pull back in this example of relationships. There's some pretty clear toxic behaviors in relationships that I think the vast majority of people would point to and say, yeah, that's not good. But then there's also nuances, right? We all have that friend who's in that marriage where you're like, I absolutely don't understand. Like, I would never, this would drive me mad. What's going on? But for that person, that's not the case, right? And so I do think that there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of gray space here. But for me, the big difference between persuasion and manipulation is when there is a lack of real value. When the consumer, the person on the other end, doesn't actually seek that value, right? If you're just trying to get them to buy it and there's no reciprocity in what is going on here, it's manipulation. I feel this way about, I'm gonna say, a very high percentage of like beauty brands. Unless there is like, okay, is it preventing skin cancer? Is it, you know, helping regulate my hormones as I enter a different phase of like, is there a health benefit Or is the only reason you're selling me this beauty brand is because you're trying to tell me that these little wrinkles showing up my face aren't very attractive and I should really, you know, get rid of those. And here's this product. That to me is manipulation. It's not persuasion. You're preying on insecurities, right? So there's always going to be persuasion. I mean, you can go look at any of the stuff that I put out as well. Like, I try to really make the case that, like, here's why I think we should all be building ethical brands. Here's why I think we should be in very healthy relationships with our consumers and our clients. But I also firmly believe that there's a group of people who aspire to achieve that value. Whereas in a lot of stuff that's happening and being sold, do those problems really exist? Do people really want that? Is that a value that they're seeking? And I think in a lot of cases, the answer is either no or I don't know. So that to me would be kind of where that line starts to get crossed.
Yeah, interesting. I can see that case in for beauty products. You know, what do you say when people say, well, I can spot manipulation when I see it, so nobody's fooling me?
In some ways, I do think there are people who are more conscious and aware of what's happening there, right? And they're engaging in it more. However, like, even doing what I do, I would never say, oh, I can spot it. Now, in hindsight or afterward, sometimes I can, and I get so irritated. I'm like, oh, I totally fell for that. Gosh. Like, but I do think, and this has also been a conversation in the comments of some of my posts, for the people who are like, I absolutely know this is happening all the time, they're the easiest target.
There's also the thing that occurs to me about this, and I always come back to, you know, the amazing documentary on Netflix, A Social Dilemma, about social media and how it's, you know, dopamine and how it's basically feeding on our hardwired need for, you know, belonging and dopamine, et cetera. But one of the scariest things about that is they said that even when we know it's happening, we are powerless to do anything about it. So I'm wondering if that applies to this as well. Knowing that it's happening, even you, when you spot it, it's almost like we're powerless to do anything about it. So how do people protect against being manipulated with stuff like this?
I think it's self-awareness and education. I could feel the resistance when you said the word powerless, because I'm like, I struggle with that one. Like, and I do think in a lot of ways, like, there's just certain things that, like, they're human nature. I'm also not a person, though, who subscribes to the fact that I'm powerless in many ways. And so I do think I firmly believe in the what you're not changing, you're choosing. And I also don't think there's anything wrong with someone who chooses, okay, this is just how it's going to be. I'm not going to lie to you. I curate my Instagram feed on purpose. Like, I will go Google something random that I want, and then I'll get all these ads, right? Like, because I want to get served the ads for certain products or things. I want to know what's on the market. Like, there are, you know, ways to also go out and use it for your own good. But I think, as far as being entirely powerless, the more educated you become, the more self-aware you become, because we're all susceptible to different things based off of who we are, how our brains were kind of programmed, what our own individual insecurities or strengths or visions of ourselves are. I just announced yesterday I'm going to go ahead and start a messaging campaign that educates consumers. They can continue to understand more and more of, like, okay, I'm seeing this, what's showing up in this? And then they can choose. You can still look at it. Like, my kids at the grocery store, like, grab for something. Oh, I want that. I'm like, oh, you know why you want that? Do you want to know why you think you want that? And of course, my oldest is 9.5, and she's like, I actually don't. Like, will you buy it for me? I'm like, no. But I'm like, look at the placement, look at the colors. Like, what is happening in you when you go get this? And then, like, let's talk about what's in the dang thing. So we use the Yuka app a lot because knowledge is power. And so we scan the stuff so you can see. And then I just show the kids, like, can you read any of these words? No. They're all chemicals. Do they have green next to them or do they have red next to them? All right, let's just open up this little box and see, causes cancer, causes whatever. Like, do you still want this thing? And they're like, nope.
What's that app called?
Yuka, Y-U-K-A.
That sounds terrifying to be looking up at. I'm not sure I want to know the answer to what's in some of my favorite foods.
We completely overhauled our entire pantry. When you scan an item, it can be health and beauty products, food. If it comes up as bad, it gives you options underneath that are better. And so when we first downloaded this app, we walked up and down multiple grocery stores. And I would say maybe 1 out of 10 things was healthy to consume.
Oh, man.
And so we ended up switching. We went to Costco. And granted, my kids are getting older, family of four. So like, we can buy in bulk. It makes sense at this point.
Yeah.
But I would say over half of the products, including frozen processed foods that we scan, are in the green.
Oh, wow. Shout out to Costco. Yeah. Don't take away my Costco mixed nuts and my these little quinoa bites that they have that are just insane that I just can't. Yeah.
I should do a case study on Costco because was like a little anti-Costco with like, is it sustainable? Right. Who needs this much? Are you just like duping me into buying more? Like, is the pricing psychology, all of this stuff. And then it's like, I go in, experience it, scan it. All their foods are great. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that's still crap, but like you can find so many great options.
Okay. So that's awesome from the consumer side. Now, as an entrepreneur, I work with a lot of founders, you know, people that wear lots of different hats, and marketing is one of the things. And so it's interesting when you talk about this stuff, because I've never met a founder that is purposely trying to manipulate people, but they have targets to meet and they're frantically trying to get their message out to try to, you know, trying lots of different, throwing all kinds of shit against the wall to see what will stick and trying to test different things. So how can they maybe be more mindful of not crossing this line, because they're not thinking about it in terms of manipulation. They're just like, shit, I gotta pay the bills and I gotta bring in this many leads that will convert to this many paying customers.
Yeah, I think there's a pause that I want to have because I actually have worked for a few founders who did not have any qualms with manipulating people into what they wanted, right? Those were the people where I learned what I didn't want to do. But for all of the, I call them conscious companies. And I've started to get a lot of outreach from several companies that are kind of in this similar space where it's like, look, we've got a little bit of a proof of concept here and we want to do this right. But I think the big thing for me is not what people say, it's what they don't say. So when you're working with founders who are only talking about money, they are only referring to human beings as cold leads, warm leads, hot leads, conversions, you are unknowingly entering into a manipulative space because you are no longer focused on the value that you are putting out into the world. You are focused on the return that you're going to get. And the thing with business is that money is a lagging metric. So you need to, money is a very clear way to track success and failure. Absolutely. But a lot of those people end up spinning their wheels, bringing in the wrong people. They think they're the wrong people because they didn't do their homework. They're not approaching them from what I call the value aspiration intersection. A lot of things in business are one-sided, but because I'm so focused on relationship, everything I do is interconnected. It's both sides of the relationship. So I do a workshop with people that I call value aspiration identification. And that's what this is it's like, okay, before you can even think about scaling, have you identified the point where what your value proposition as a company is and the value seeking of the consumer is, where those things meet? And I don't just mean in your head, you think you have the answer. Have you done some research? Have you asked the consumer? Right? Because if you haven't, you're in no place to scale. it won't be sustainable over time because you're going to be constantly just trying to come up with new tactics to throw against the wall to get people to convert into something that they don't actually want or need. I say these things, I should add, there's a ton of research. There's a ton of research around this. It's like if you speak to the emotional trigger of someone, you easily 2x your conversions. Easily. Lead generation, super easy. I like to say, like, if you're doing this correctly, you're not selling, you're inviting. And at the same time, if you have an emotionally engaged audience, you can increase your profit margin up to 30% before that emotionally engaged audience will go, now I'm not sure. Because at that point, they trust you. And you know what's even better? They go tell their friends about you. They go post about you. People become embodied extensions of your brand when they feel like they belong with your brand as their authentic selves. Right? And so I think that's where I was at. And I've had a question before that's like, you know, I mean, how do you sell this to people? Because people want money right now. And I'm like, sure, but like, would you rather have like 300 leads in the next 30 days that don't convert? Or would you rather build a relationship with 30 people who buy from you for the rest of their life and tell everyone about what you do?
Yeah. You're not selling, you're inviting. Ooh, I love that.
Yeah. I've started using a lot of like invitation and co-creation language in what I'm doing. You want to talk about maybe an area of being powerless. The effects of what money does to the psyche is a real thing. And so they're like, look, we have proof of concept. We've sold several million, you know, and we want to scale it, but we know we have to stay true to these values because that's foundational to how we got started. And it's a core to the mission behind why we're doing what we're doing.
Well, coming back to that idea of ethical branding, so you talked about Costco. So I want to contrast that to Target. So you wrote about how your daughter came to you and said, I don't want to shop at Target anymore. And it kind of went viral. Tell me a bit about Target's story and what led up to that quote.
You said the T word and my brain went dun, dun, dun. Such a sad story. It really is. Like, I love Target too. Yeah, so my daughter is 9. And at the beginning of this year, we were on our way to a birthday party. And she wanted to grab something. You know, they do chores, so they get some allowance. I don't remember. It's probably a Lego or something. She wanted to stop. And so I told her, I said, hey, there's one thing that I do want to let you know about Target. Because these are the conversations we have in our family. And I had told her, like, Target had rolled back their DEI initiatives. And so she wanted to know what that meant. So I was trying to give her a pretty objective, just here's some facts about what that means. And she would just looked at me and she was like, I don't want to shop at Target anymore. And so, okay. And as we're walking into like the trampoline park or where we were going, I don't know why I didn't, but I just kind of typed up a little post. I was like kind of proud of her. Like, there's this 9-year-old who loves Target and, to be honest, has a fantastic Lego selection. And she is like, no, this goes against my values. This is not the kind of store, like the values I thought. And so I'm not going in. And so I made a post and it went totally viral. And so I did a follow-up this week because it's now been like 3 or 4 months. And my daughter still refuses to step foot into a Target. And on occasion, she will ask me, Mom, has Target done the right thing yet? And I have to be like, well, if you're asking if they've reestablished like some of these things, like, no, they're still in this spot. And she's like, okay, I'm not going. I mean, to the point where the girls and I, we were looking for swimsuits and we were running out of options. And I knew that Target would probably have a whole bunch. And it was down to like, okay, the pools are opening and either we can go into a Target and get you a swimsuit or we might have to order online. You won't have one this weekend. And my daughters are 9 and 5 and they looked at each other in the car and then looked at me and went, we're not going in a Target. Chose not to have swimsuits to maybe not go to the pool. Like, that's how firmly they were in that. And so it's like, if children are in that space, of course there's adults in that space. And as I've been reading about all of this, it's like I get a little bit sick to my stomach because I read all of these reports, right? Everyone's trying to position themselves around being the expert and why Target is plummeting. And it's like, sure, there's all of these like other little pieces around it. Absolutely. But at the core of it, like they broke trust. They broke the trust. We all felt duped. We realized you're just going to say whatever you need to say to us to get us to come in your store and make money. And if you think that you can make more money by changing the direction, then you're going to do it. I'm actually working with a friend of mine. His name is Avante Daniels. If you are listening to this and you don't know who Avante Daniels is and you're enjoying this conversation, I highly encourage you to go check him out. So he has this thing called the CRI. It's the Cultural Resiliency Index. And the reason I wrote about Target again is because he had sent me kind of a report. And when you look at everything that he'd put together, they've been on a path. They didn't just do it overnight. That was just the one big public thing that did it. They've been making decisions that have pulled them away from their core values over the last 2 years. There is a point at which, though, that the public finally goes, whoa, okay, now we see it. And not only do people see it, more importantly, they feel it.
Yeah.
Like the heart and the gut are going to town way before the brain gets on the train. Like.
Yeah, trust. So something you've mentioned a couple of times, and I wanted to come back to it, Chelsea, this idea of belonging. You've written about it a little bit. You've kind of alluded to it a little bit today. How does this sense of belonging tie into this? Because when I was reading about it, it really seemed to scratch an itch, be like, that really seems, there's something really compelling about that. And I don't know how to articulate it. I'm sure you can do a better job than I can.
Well, and to be honest with you, I'm still working on articulating it. So the backstory with belonging, in my graduate program at USC, we had to conduct our own empirical research. I, at the time, was working with a global coaching company. I had proximity to a lot of entrepreneurs, predominantly female entrepreneurs. And so I chose to do a study on sense of belonging, the actual psychological construct of belonging in female entrepreneurs. And what I uncovered was that women, specifically women entrepreneurs who have actively participated in coaching and or community, have a higher sense of belonging. And that higher sense of belonging leads to better cognitive functioning. It leads to holistic health, lower blood pressure, lower rates of anxiety and mental health issues. It actually is positively correlated with revenue and receiving venture capital. Like, it went way deeper than just, I feel better about myself. Their businesses were more successful if they had a higher sense of belonging. And so that was really kind of the tip of the iceberg for me. And again, as I sat crisscross applesauce on the couch behind us, it was like, this is a core piece of something. This is a use case that like, and since then, since that time, belonging got added onto DEI, right? So it was something that people were definitely seeing as like, okay, you can't just hire diversely and have equitable hiring processes and then bring people into a system that's not built for them. Of course they will not succeed. So how do we create environments and systems where people feel like they can belong? Because belonging has to start here. You have to belong to yourself before you can belong with others. Because if you don't know who you are and how you belong with yourself, you can never be authentic. So the way that I'm pulling it into branding is I built out a framework called the Belong Framework and break down these six different pillars of what it looks like to build a belong, what I call a belong brand. But as I've gone deeper with this, it's like, you know what? This can really affect the loneliness epidemic because we're all in relationships with these brands and these companies, whether we want to agree with it or not. I mean, you think about, we put ourselves in relationships with celebrities. We think we know these people. You know what I mean? Like you relate to them on that level. We do the same thing with brands. So if that's what's happening with brands, but brands are constantly gaslighting you and crossing your boundaries and trying to sell you without consent, like all of these things that exist in the relationship space, what is it doing to our sense of belonging? Right? And we're already in this loneliness epidemic. What if a brand truly cared about you? What if they saw you and they knew you and what they were offering to you, what they were inviting you to come join them in, was actually in alignment with the higher version of you that you wanted to become, with the world that you wanted to create? And I know it sounds big and it sounds like fluffy, but this is, goes all the way down to the product level. You know, I'd take a picture. Oh, I moved it. I had a my granola bar wrapper. And like, and on the back, right? It's like, hey, here's what we believe. And here's what we do with our money. And like on the back of the granola bar wrapper. And I, of course, always go look these things up and check it out. And it's like, no, like, not only is this checking the boxes for what I'm willing and wanting to like consume and fuel my body with, but it's also fueling the vision of the world that I want to participate in.
A brand that can make me feel like the person, not that I am, that I want to be, you know, and I think just maybe like the simplest version is maybe a gym membership or something. Like, I want to be the person that goes to the gym every day, that goes there and has a community and chats with people in a supportive environment. I want to be that person. And that's why every January and February, thousands of people go and flood it. And then they turns out that there's some resistance and 10% of the people are still there in March. But I mean, is that a simple example of how people can think about belonging? Like, who is your customer want to become, and how do we help them create a space or invite them into a place to help them be that person?
Exactly. No, that's a really good example. And if we continue on with gyms, right? Different gyms offer different things. Sure, they have a lot of the same equipment. You walk in and you can do the same exercises in most of these gyms. But like for me right now, my children are 9 and 5. I want a gym where I can bring my children, where my oldest, my moody preteen, can do her thing in like a cool little rec space and is safe. Or they can come with me and they can exercise with me and they can be a part of that because we do those things together, right? Versus the membership that my 28-year-old friend has where nobody brings their kids to it. It's cheap and accessible, but you get free tanning because she wants to tan, right? Like, those are two very different motivators. We could both walk into each other's gyms and do the same workout. The difference is how those things are aligning with who we are right now and who we want to become. So yeah, I do think that that's a really good example of creating that sense of belonging. And at the same time, as you do that, there's this inadvertent, just holistic well-being that these businesses are working toward. We may not notice it, but the dissonance in an unhealthy brand relationship can wear us down. You know, it's just like consuming all of the media and all of the news. And it's like, it's so much chaos. And when it's all pulling at us to try to separate us from our values, to try to get us to go this way or that way without being in tune with who we are, telling us narratives that we know are gaslighting. Like, no, I know this about myself, but I still click on the beauty ads on Instagram at 2 a.m. when I can't sleep, right? And I'm like, this one's going to do it, right? Like,
when I'm at my weakest, like I would never click on this ad when I woke up after a run or a long walk, like you said, and I'm feeling like the strongest version of myself. But man, when I'm weak and tired and
yes,
I'm susceptible. Yeah. And they know it.
I mean, there's definitely products. Like, you should have to answer the questions like, have you slept 8 hours? Have you eaten? And have you had a glass of water? And you can't buy this product until you've done those things. Like,
oh man, I've bought some like sketchy things on Instagram, you know, late at night or whatever. And it shows up. It's like, what is this garbage? Like, I don't know. It's just I'm susceptible to these impulse buys, things that I would never buy if I was actually thinking clearly.
Yep.
This conversation, Chelsea, man, I've got so many things running through my head. I'm going to get that app. I have a feeling I'm going to be viewing ads and emails differently through this new lens. I'm so excited about this. There's so much more I wish we would have gotten to. But before we go, I want to ask you what you're most excited about next. You mentioned a book. So is like, how far away is that?
Yeah. So book is, I mean, let's be honest, people. I am a mompreneur with two young kids. So book is happening. Book will be next year. But what I'm really excited about is that yesterday, after dozens of guest episodes, I actually recorded my first episode of my own podcast called Uncouched, featuring beautiful mustard yellow couch behind you or behind me.
Love it.
And that is what I'm really excited about. So I'm going to be having just a lot of, well, I think, rad, wicked smart people on. The whole point of Uncouched is to kind of be just really kind of like debunk our current narratives, the way we think about just a variety of different topics. I'll be providing a lens of applied psychology. So really breaking down the brain science and digging into what that looks like and getting really curious about the implications of what's going on in our world right now. And kind of exploring this idea of like, where could this go? The good, the bad, and the ugly. So yeah, Uncouched. It's going to be launching the second week in July. And so that's what I'm most excited about.
I'm so excited for you. That is going to be amazing. And so for people that have liked this conversation, want to learn more about you, they can find you on LinkedIn. Anywhere else?
So I do have a website, the-marketing-psychologist.com. But I will say I love to have conversations with people. So come on over to LinkedIn, send a connection request, introduce yourself. I would love to chat and have you join into the dialogue that we're having in the comments, because it's really, it's good stuff.
Yeah. And I can attest there was something about your content that spoke to me. I guess I probably started following you, I don't know, 6 months or so ago. I became a big fan. I reached out, which led to this conversation, and I couldn't be more grateful for it. This has been amazing, Chelsea.
Same. Thank you so much for this conversation.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.